Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we'll talk about kids featured in online content. Some parents have made a business out of showing their children's big moments, but the kids don't always get a cut. Illinois now has a law to ensure they get a share. We'll talk about the Republican National Convention. It kicks off Monday in Milwaukee. We'll visit with delegates from Illinois and get a better view of where Republicans are headed in an overall blue state. We'll also have details on an investigation that finds some domestic violence survivors have been punished for crimes committed by their abusers. Illinois corn growers are pushing back against new rules for vehicle emissions. While not as popular as it once was, canning is seeing a resurgence. We'll get a report, and we'll hear from a musician with new material that pays homage to a part of the state known as Forgottonia. All coming up on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Imagine if millions of people watched you grow up and saw every embarrassing moment captured. For the generation that's grown up with social media, that can be their reality. Some families have created entire businesses out of filming content of their kids and posting it on platforms like YouTube or TikTok. But there's not much guarantee the kids will get their share of the profits, much less their privacy. Illinois is now the first state to pass a law that compensates kids for this type of content. It was inspired by Shreya Nilamulto, an Illinois teen who wrote a letter to her state senator. Sasha Ann Simon spoke with her and Caroline Isom, a comedian and content creator who's an advocate on the issue.
Shreya, what made you reach out to your state senator?
I learned about child influencers over the pandemic, and I was just shocked that this exploitation was kind of happening in plain sight, and there was no legislation in place to protect these kids. So I decided to reach out to my state senator.
What's it been like for you growing up in this age with social media?
Lots of my peers and people I know want to be influencers. It's been pretty normalized, and so many child influencers have honestly grown up alongside me.
Mm. That's interesting. It paints such a different picture when I recall my, you know, teenage years.
Yeah, you know, I feel like influencing is the new hot career. It seems so glamorous, but when you really learn more about it, especially when you get into it from a young age, it's a lot more sinister than it seems.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us about this law. How does it work exactly?
It's designed to kind of allow these kids compensation for the income that they are generating. And so if a video is generating enough revenue, you know, this is for actual family bloggers, not just parents who are posting their kids online.
Mm-hmm.
Then if the child is in the video, let's say 30% of the time, then half of that percentage, so 15% of the video's revenue, has to be deposited in a trust account for them.
So parents will put aside 50% of the earnings to their child, and it's based on the percentage of time that they're featured in a given video.
Yes, exactly.
The law also allows teens that are over 18 to take legal action.
Yes.
And so this is if their parents featured them in a monetized video and they didn't pay them for it.
Yeah, you know, ideally these parents would be proactive. You know, we always want to assume that they have the kid's best interest in mind, but this is kind of a fallback for these kids if that doesn't happen.
Right. Caroline, let's bring you in here because this is the first state, Illinois, to actually put any regulations on the books when it comes to this topic. Why do you think that we haven't seen more legislation so far?
I think the technology is just relatively so new. When cars were first invented, we didn't have seatbelt laws or drunk driving laws or anything like that. All of that came later. And I think that we're in the Wild West era of social media and that the laws just have to catch up to the technology.
Yeah, you said earlier, Shreya, that this, you know, this now feels like our new norm. Now that the law is in place, though, how are you feeling about that and what it will do for your peers that you say are really immersed in this kind of work?
You know, I'm really excited. I hope it can offer them some protection. I didn't want this law to be kind of stifling that dream if they wanted to be an influencer, but rather, you know, giving them an extra layer of protection if they need it.
Your thoughts, Caroline?
I think the law is a great stepping stone. Now, as to the question of should kids be in monetized content at all, I don't think so.
Hmm.
But
why not?
One step at a time.
What's your reasoning?
I think that, first of all, it sets up this dynamic of your parents are your employer, and your workplace is your home, and your work is performing the details and private moments of your life for an audience. I think that people have this misconception that, oh, it's just putting a camera in there, but it's what these kids are always doing anyway. It's just their normal life. But I think of family vlog content like reality TV, in that it takes so much effort to make it happen. Mm-hmm. And effort that the kids are having to make. When I see a video of a toddler trying on 5 different outfits, I used to work as a preschool teacher, and I know that that's not so easy for a 2-year-old.
Yeah.
And I think that it puts a lot at stake. It puts your family dynamics at stake to be profiting off of being visible mm-hmm. for people.
As much as the next person, I'm entertained by a lot of these videos. I remember yesterday catching for the first time a particular family that I think they're super popular, but I had just seen them for the first time. They've got 2 toddler sons, and the older one does these voiceovers that are, you know, just hilarious. Like, he voices over, you know, other comedian content, and it's funny and so forth. But what happened was I watched another video that happened to show the behind the scenes of how long it takes to film this child saying the lines and making sure that his lips are moving, you know, with the actual words. And I was thinking, oh my goodness, he's like 4 at best. And like, that's a lot of work. And so this regulation, Caroline, though it helps address this compensation issue that we've been talking about when it comes to these kids, what more would you like to see?
France has a law that no children can be in monetized content before the age of 16. Ideally, I would want us to work towards that mm-hmm. because it's not just an issue of potentially messing with your family dynamics. It's not just an issue of kids working, because it is work. And I think a lot of people love to scoff at influencers. And because they like to scoff at influencers and not recognize that influencers are doing work, however mm-hmm. difficult or not difficult that work is, they don't acknowledge that the kids are doing work. But beyond that, it's just so deeply unsafe in terms of creeps on the internet.
And you will talk to parents who say, I mean, our children are not working. We're just capturing moments as they happen. How do you respond to something like that, Caroline? I'd actually love to hear from both of you, but you first, Caroline.
I find that so disingenuous. The children are working, they're performing. These parents that defend what they're doing, they have a huge financial interest in defending what they're doing. But I've spoken to parents who didn't know who I was, in terms of they didn't know that I have a big heart for activism for kids on social media. And I was just at a social media type event, and a parent told me that they don't understand why people are so outraged that they did a Dove campaign with their baby naked in the tub. Mm. These parents are willfully ignoring the harms of what they're doing because it's making them so much money.
What are your thoughts, Treya? What kind of strain does this put on the kids?
It's really not natural to the parents that are saying it's just, you know, like a home video. It's so much more different than that, because you have to have these kids, you know, sometimes parents make them pose for thumbnails, or they surprise them with something and they make them do 5-6 takes of the same thing. It's not natural, and it's not just filming their everyday life. There's a leaked clip of a YouTuber instructing her son, who was already crying, I think over a pet, they lost their pet, to pose in a different way for the thumbnail. And I think that just perfectly encapsulates how these parents expect their kids to act for a vlog, because it's not real life.
And can young kids actually understand what it means to upload a video to social media and consent to this type of work, Shreya?
I really don't think so. You know, it's hard for even now to imagine 1,000 people, let alone 1,000,000 people. And, you know, when you're that young, you don't understand really how permanent the internet is. And it's not your fault that you don't understand that. No one is explaining that to these kids. They're just really vulnerable out here and being exploited for views.
Caroline, you created a TikTok series satirizing family vloggers and showing what might go on behind the scenes. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that I called that series the Sandwich Family series, and I've done a lot of satire of family vlogging. My goal with all of my satire is to point out the camera. I think that we are primed to take the camera for granted as if it's something that's natural to be there. But the question I'm trying to encourage people to ask is, why do I have access to this? Should I have access to this? And who is benefiting from me having access to this? There's gentle parenting family vloggers that will set the camera up and then they'll talk to their kids about the toy they broke and how that was irresponsible and how they needed to calm their body down. And you'll see the comments full of people who experienced rough childhood saying it's so refreshing to see a parent handle their kids gently. And I just want to scream, but it's not gentle because the camera's there. Like, you can't take this content as what it would be if the camera was not there.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen to one of your skits.
We're going to have to do that again. You don't seem surprised at all.
I'm not surprised. We've done this 1,000 times.
It's called acting. Try it.
I am acting. How much more do you want me to do, Mom? I already seem insane.
One child of family vloggers reached out to you. What did they share with you?
This was over 2 years ago when I had just been doing other skits. And their identity is anonymous. They're a teenager. They're still in this situation. And they told me that my content helped them realize that they were being exploited. And they shared a lot of the difficulties of being in a family vlog. They had seen countless crude messages about them from the time that they were little. They had been made to perform on every major day of their life. They had also been made to perform when they lost a pet. Mm-hmm. Nothing was precious. Nothing was sacred. And they really emphasized to me how the employer-employee dynamic was the thing that potentially harmed them the most out of everything, was just being their parents' employee. Mm. And they told me that it's not worth it. They wrote a letter that I shared publicly. And in that letter, they said, if any parents are thinking about doing this, I want you to know that it's not worth it.
Caroline Isom and Shreya Nelamaltu discussing a new law that compensates kids who are featured in online content. They spoke with Sasha Ann Simons. The U.S. Department of Education hosted a regional summit last month at the University of Illinois Chicago. Leaders from across the country convened to collect ideas on how to tackle teacher shortages. Peter Medlin was there and has this report. Can we
first start off by getting education leaders from 11 states gathered in a small university classroom. Roberto Rodriguez stood up to speak first. He's the U.S. Department of Education's Assistant Secretary in the Office of Planning, Evaluation, and Policy Development.
It's one of the most important challenges we have to tackle in public education.
That's why his department is holding 3 of these events across the country to brainstorm solutions. And they chose to hold this one here in Illinois because of the state's work opening up new pathways to become teachers and prioritizing teacher diversity. Illinois State Superintendent Tony Sanders says they've set diversity goals for teacher prep programs and invested in a new teacher vacancy grant over the past few years.
It's funded again this year for $45 million, and it's giving resources to the top 20% of school districts that have 80% of the vacancies.
To that point, shortages look very different depending on the school. Low income and schools with higher numbers of students of color tend to have more severe shortages, and some roles like special education, early childhood, and bilingual tend to be the most difficult to fill. One of the ways to get teachers into those hard to staff roles that Rodriguez talked about is for schools to grow their own. That means recruiting high school students or paraprofessionals to get their teaching license, which the school then helps pay for. Recently, more and more Illinois schools have experimented with those models. Rodriguez says the Department of Ed is also investing tens of millions of dollars into a type of grow-your-own teacher apprenticeships. In 2021, the Biden administration's Department of Labor approved teaching as a registered apprenticeship, which opens up federal funding for states with apprenticeship programs. Rodriguez says 35 states now have teacher apprenticeships.
Right now, we have over 1,200 candidates across the country moving through those apprenticeships. We think that has a lot of promise.
Illinois just launched its own pilot program this spring. Jarvis Lundy is the director of education diversity at the Hunt Institute, an education nonprofit, and at the UIC event, he emphasized that it's also important who those teachers are. Research shows it's beneficial to all students when schools' teacher demographics reflect their student demographics, and Lundy says that's where growing your own and recruiting paraprofessionals can have another advantage.
If you look at a paraprofessional pool, especially in early learning, it's almost flipped on its head. We have, you know, a majority women of color specifically, right? So how do we identify and support those folks if they'd like to become teachers?
Zachary Levine also presented in Chicago. He's the founding executive director of Teach.org, and he says they have two programs, Future Black Teachers and Future Latino Teachers, which support students who show an interest in becoming educators.
There was a survey of 1,000 Black high school students who wanted to become teachers when they were in high school. 6 years later, 14 of them had become teachers. That underscores the need for a support system.
On the federal level, Rodriguez says the Department of Ed recently invested $450 million into teacher diversity grants. But there's also another problem to solve. How can schools keep good teachers? A recent Illinois survey found the top two reasons teachers left the field are salary and burnout. Illinois has a $40,000 minimum teacher salary, and that's similar to its neighbors, but other states have higher minimums, and some are raising theirs. In Maryland, all teachers will make at least $60,000 a year by 2026. Burnout is more complicated. Rodriguez says teachers are
carrying a heavier load than they ever have.
Sanders says there needs to be more conversations about teacher working conditions, and Levine at Teach.org says addressing student mental health can go a long way. In the meantime, Levine says he's already been hearing interesting ideas at the regional meeting. Why not add an interested in teaching box students can check next to the interested in the military option? And it wouldn't be the first time they look to the military for ideas. Levine says his organization has a program in four states borrowing U.S. Army recruitment techniques to entice potential teachers across the country, and so far, so good. He says they've gotten almost 6,000 new diverse recruits into teacher prep programs with that strategy. But from the federal government to the local level, school leaders like these know they'll have to stay creative and keep investing if they want to bring in good teachers and keep the ones they've got. I'm Peter Medlin.
We've got more of Statewide on the way. Stay right here. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Still ahead, an Illinois law puts domestic violence survivors in prison for the crimes of their abusers. We'll have more. That's coming up. But first, the Republican National Convention kicks off next week in Milwaukee. Maria Gardner-Lara caught up with a delegate from Northern Illinois who will be there.
Jan Kloss says she wasn't surprised by President Joe Biden's performance at the debate.
I wasn't really expecting much out of the debate, any new information. It seems to me that I'm just surprised that so many people were so upset with Biden's cognitive response, because I thought, well, he's been doing this in the news.
Kloss is a vice chairperson for the Winnebago County Republican Party and a Trump delegate for the Republican National Convention. She's also a trustee of the Cherry Valley Township.
These are our choices, these two guys. And so I prefer Trump because of his policies, not his moral leadership and not his kind of, I don't know, his personality that is offensive to some people. I like his policies much better than Biden.
Her background is in nursing. Her family runs a financial services firm. She was drawn to politics through her involvement in the homeschool movement in the 90s. She identifies as a Christian and shares the beliefs of conservative evangelicals on abortion, family, and marriage. She found that the Republican Party aligns with her views. Kloss considers herself a, quote, platform Republican. In addition to social issues, she says the party platform includes a strong military, increased border security, less regulation, and lower taxes. She says the party platform helps to measure up candidates or elected officials carrying the Republican banner.
Sometimes candidates want to say, well, I'm a Republican, but then when they vote for tax increases and abortion on demand and against school choice, and that's not sticking with what our platform says. And you do that too much of the time, and you're probably going to have somebody challenge you in the next election.
She says at the convention, they'll vote on the National Republican Party platform. Leading into the convention, State Republican Party Chairman Don Tracy resigned, citing intra-party disputes. Claus says the divisiveness isn't new and goes back several elections. Currently, the Democratic Party holds a supermajority in the Illinois House. She says some of the differences within the party are based on geography.
You might have some of the Republicans that are in the urban areas that don't value our position on some of the social issues like abortion, traditional marriage, even some differences in education.
While there are differences within the party, she says the Illinois delegation is united for Trump's nomination at the convention. Then in November, Claus plans to accept the outcome of the election.
And I've been involved in our party, in our county, with improving our election integrity and training poll watchers and understanding the mail-in ballot process better. And so I think there's a lot more eyes on the process this time around.
The Republican National Convention starts July 15 in Milwaukee. The Democratic National Convention will be held in Chicago starting August 19th. I'm Maria Gardner Lara.
A new investigation by the Marshall Project found over 100 cases of domestic violence survivors who were punished for a crime committed by their abusers. The cases found in Illinois involve a little-known law called the Theory of Accountability that allows a person to be prosecuted for another's crime if they assisted or helped, even in some cases if that help was provided only under threat of violence. The Marshall Project's Shannon Heffernan explains, and a heads up, this story includes descriptions of violence.
When Patricia Johnson met Ray Travieso, she was only 17. He was 35. But she came from a poor family, and he made sure she had what she needed. Stable housing, medicine for her mom. Once he gave Johnson a beautiful pair of earrings, gold and dangly. They were a symbol of his ability to provide for her. But one day, in the parking lot of a Sizzler restaurant, the meaning of those earrings changed. Johnson offhandedly complimented another man's car, and Travieso got mad at her for giving him attention.
So when we got out of the car, he knocked me down. He hit me so hard, the earring flew out of my ear, and I was trying to look for it. But I wasn't really looking for the earring. I was so embarrassed, I didn't want to go into the Sizzlers.
After that day, she said the abuse escalated. A shattered glass table, a belt buckle to the face. Johnson's niece, Tremika Turner Mason, was just a kid. She remembers how her Aunt Patricia seemed so young and lively. Johnson took them to the beach and brought them junk food.
Loved to go to Dunkin' Donuts. Oh my goodness, that was like our thing. I got like obsessed with jelly donuts.
But eventually, as Johnson was with Travieso, those outings turned sour.
This particular day, I was like, oh, I really want to go to Dunkin' Donut. So she was like, yeah, we can go. So we went to Dunkin' Donut. We went back to her house, and Ray got there, and he was angry that day.
Angry because Johnson wasn't home when he called. Turner Mason could hear him beating her in the next room.
I had already started eating my jelly donut, and I just threw up.
To this day, Turner Mason doesn't eat jelly donuts. Johnson says Travieso had incredible power over her life, monitored her so closely that fearing him was almost like fearing God. On the afternoon of January 16th, 1992, 7 years after they met, Travieso asked Johnson to come with him to take care of some business. He drove her to the house of his business partner, Juan Hernandez. They went to his living room, where Hernandez's wife, Olga, was sitting with their baby, Evelyn, on her lap. The two men started arguing about cash. Then there was a knock at the door, and Travieso pulled out a gun.
There was some type of delivery, and I think it was a pizza man. And he told me exactly to say, the order's been canceled. Say it now. And I said, the order was canceled. And he said, sit down. And I seen a lamp over in the corner, and I thought about picking it up. And I said to myself, if I pick up that lamp and hit him and he doesn't fall, he's going to kill me. I pondered on that lamp, and I pondered on that lamp.
Medical examiner's reports show what happened. The parents were beaten and their throats were slashed. The baby was bashed to death. Johnson says after Travieso killed them, he told her to gather up jewelry and put it in a bag.
And he looked at me and he said, you're going to take this to your grave with you, right? I said, you know, I won't say anything.
Travieso did not kill Johnson that day. But in a way, he still took her life. Since 1993, she has been sitting in a prison for those murders. She's serving a life sentence, just like Travieso. Prosecutors didn't have to prove Johnson laid a finger on anyone to send her to prison. Because of Illinois' theory of accountability, Johnson was guilty if she assisted Travieso, even under duress. I tracked down one of the jurors in the case, who asked not to be named out of fear for retaliation from Travieso. Watching the trial, two things were clear to this juror. One, Johnson was there at the murders and provided at least some support. And two, Johnson would have never done anything like that if not for Travieso and his control over her.
There was more than three victims. Of course, the family was victimized, but she was a victim too.
Still, the juror felt like she had to follow the law. And ultimately, the jury came back with a guilty verdict. She remembers crying with the other jurors.
And it was very difficult to reach the consensus we had, and it was difficult to be forced to follow those rules.
Travieso has changed his story over time about what happened, at one point directly implicating Johnson in some of the murders. But when I wrote him in prison to ask him about it, his answer was short. He said Johnson, quote, should have never been in prison. All these years, I felt bad about it all. I found nearly 100 cases like Johnson's across the country, where a person, almost always a woman, was incarcerated for assisting, supporting, or failing to stop a crime of their abuser. The survivors often had clear signs of abuse at the time they were arrested. One Illinois woman was in a neck brace. Some Illinois lawmakers and activists have tried to change the theory of accountability so people are not punished the same way as the person who actually committed the act. At a hearing last year, State Representative Will Guzzardi spoke in support of a bill that would narrow the law.
We can't hold people legally responsible for the actions of everybody around them that they couldn't possibly have any foreknowledge of.
Another Democrat, Dave Vella, pushed against it.
You're accountable for the people you do nasty things with. And if something bad happens, you should be accountable for the bad act.
The law failed to pass, but activists say they are still pushing for change. Since the conviction, Johnson has come out as a trans man. He still uses she/her pronouns when discussing his past life and asks that we do the same because he says living as a woman was central to the abusive dynamic with Travieso. Johnson is now 55 years old and has spent more than half his life behind bars. Prison can be hard on a body. His teeth are in bad shape and he sometimes uses a cane. But he says he no longer fears Ray Travieso, no longer thinks he's as powerful and omniscient as God. Instead, he prays constantly, on calls with his family, with women who come to his cell for help, with his lawyer during meetings, and at the end of our interview. Johnson says he owes it to God to be brave. I'm Shannon Heffernan.
That story, produced in partnership with the Marshall Project, a nonprofit news organization focused on the U.S. criminal justice system. The Illinois Department of Transportation wants to know if an express bus service between Peoria and Bloomington is a realistic project, Tim Shelley reports.
A $1.2 million federal grant will allow IDOT to study the feasibility of connecting the two communities via public transit along the I-74 corridor. Rima Abiyakar is a senior planner with the Tri-County Regional Planning Commission, which isn't directly involved with this study. She notes that though Peoria is advocating for its own passenger rail route to Chicago, Normal currently has the closest available Amtrak link.
So any sort of study that can show us different options, how we can move forward, give folks more accessibility to public transportation, It's only a good thing.
The envisioned route would likely provide new links to major regional employers like Caterpillar, Rivian, and OSF Healthcare. Abia Carr says the study is also looking at bringing bus service to Morton and Goodfield, communities that currently lack public transit options.
So that would fill a really important gap. So it's hard to understand what is lacking sometimes until you actually fill a gap.
The study is set to begin in late 2025 and take around 2 years to complete.
Tim Shelley with that story. A 16-county region in western Illinois acquired the nickname Forgottonia more than half a century ago. It's a nickname still in use today, and Forgottonia is the title of a new show of original material by a Macomb-based musician. Rich Egger tells us about it.
The show has been years in the making.
Oh, yeah.
This was recorded during a rehearsal in January. Chris Villillo is the creative force behind the project. Forgottonia was a political stunt in the early 1970s to draw attention to the lack of funding for road improvements in the region. It worked, and Chris arrived in Forgottonia in the mid-70s on the first wave of highway funding that came into the region.
I was hired as a staff archaeologist for Western Illinois University to work on what would become, 30 years later, mind you, the Kansas City-Chicago Expressway.
As a musician, Chris also started writing a series of songs explaining the region through the eyes of an outsider. The title song, Forgottonia, was started in the 1980s. Chris was writing music for what would become his first recording, but the song was not finished, so it got set aside and was, well, forgotten about.
In the haste of doing the recording, producing the recording, and everything that's involved in that, the notes from that song just ended up stuck in a drawer. And they sat there until 2017, when I was cleaning out the house after my folks passed, and I came across them.
Chris says through the benefit of decades of hindsight, he realized that he captured the essence of small-town rural Illinois. And he realized he better finish the song.
Little town news, rusty old horseshoes, hanging up above the weather door.
The new show will feature Chris on stage with a couple other crackerjack musicians, jazz mandolin player Don Sternberg and acoustic bass player Mark Edelstein. And they will be accompanied by a series of images of Forgottonia that will be projected throughout the performance. Those are the work of award-winning photographer Tim Schroll.
I've always said that Tim does visually what I try to do musically.
Chris went through thousands of Tim's photos. The two then discussed the images that each picked out. They talked about the music, and the show started coming together. Chris says he enjoyed working with Tim because of his sense of proportion and his sense of light and dark, which are all critical to his black and white photos.
He literally thinks about the shots and knows what time of year he wants to shoot a spot at because of the right kind of light. He knows the weather conditions he wants, and he will wait 6 months to find that perfect thing before he then goes out to make the shot.
Chris calls it an old-school Ansel Adams approach to photography.
Okay, going into the last A part, two, three.
Forgottonia will debut on July 20th at the Hainline Theater on the Western Illinois University campus in Macomb. The show begins at 7 o'clock. Tickets are $20 and can be ordered through Chris Villillo's website. Chris says in putting together the show, he had to decide whether it should be a trip down memory lane or a celebration of the region today, or perhaps something else.
I think the point is to celebrate the heritage, to re-envision what rural Illinois is all about, and to express it through the eyes of someone who isn't a product of it.
Some people did not like the term Forgottonia 50-plus years ago, and a few still fight against it today. But Chris calls it a brilliant political act that celebrates the area's heritage while publicizing that the region is isolated and often overlooked when it comes to state and federal funding.
And now people are embracing that as a fact that, you know, if you want to know what small town America life is, come to Unforgettable Fort Gatonia, because we live it every day.
And you can live it through Chris Velillo's music and Tim Schroll's photos in the show Forgotonia. Rich Egger reporting.
We'll be back with more of Statewide in just a moment. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Illinois corn growers are joining a lawsuit over new vehicle emissions rules. Those rules, recently announced by the Environmental Protection Agency, would be phased in over several years, starting in 2027. They would mandate automakers reduce the average emissions of their new vehicles. The rules are intended to boost electric vehicle production and ultimately limit the release of climate-warming greenhouse gases. The Illinois Corn Growers Association sees that as a threat to ethanol, a threat that would substantially reduce demand for the corn they produce. Dave Luce is director of biofuels for the Illinois Corn Growers Association. He outlines his concerns in a conversation with Colin Hardman.
Our concern is that US EPA is doing this in a way that is beyond their statutory authority. They did not do a very good job of assessing the true costs of this program, either for the auto manufacturers themselves, the logistics of putting in infrastructure to accommodate 67% of these vehicles being produced by 2032, and they didn't account for consumer preference, or they did not account for the generation capacity needed to provide the electricity for this huge mandate and transition into all electric vehicles. So the basic premise is that they overstepped their statutory authority given by Congress under the Clean Air Act.
Now, you're a biofuels expert, so one of the things I wanted you to ask about naturally is how this will affect the fuel ethanol that's been implemented to various degrees. So one of the things I was wondering is, it's been told this will be expected to impact corn farmers, as that's the way that we produce the ethanol, and waste a whole lot of their production. Let's say, worst case scenario from your perspective, lawsuit is unsuccessful, rule remains exactly as it is. Are those farmers forced to switch to another crop, or how will they need to react?
So this rule would result in our estimation of a loss of 1 billion bushels of corn demand by 2033. And that is pretty significant. Economists out of Nebraska has indicated that a demand destruction of this magnitude for agriculture would be similar to what agriculture has seen in the 80s. And we're already going through a period of time when prices of raising a crop are higher and the returns are much lower. And in many cases, the farmers are not recovering enough in revenue to cover the cost of producing the crop. So this loss of demand for corn ethanol is huge to us, and especially when we think that there's other options and strategies out there that could help meet these standards.
Now, I wanted to talk a little bit more about the intentions of the rules and how you feel about the obvious motive to combat climate change. How do you see the relationship between ethanol and electrified vehicles in that endeavor? Do you see the value in electrified vehicles, but perhaps this may just not be the way that you would prefer it to be done?
We're all about reducing emissions, both the controlled emissions like NOx and CO, but also CO2 emissions, where we've been working on that for quite a few years now, on looking at different farming practices that can reduce these emissions. We're also working closely with the ethanol industry. Many of these ethanol plants have promised to be net carbon zero by a certain time in the future. We see some tremendous benefits that ethanol can play in reducing carbon emissions and the other toxic emissions associated with internal combustion engines. But the way to do that is to reduce the carbon score of corn ethanol, which we're doing right now on both the farming side and on the ethanol plant side. You've read about the carbon capture and sequestration. That can significantly reduce, you know, almost a third of the CO2 output from an ethanol plant.
So I think it's fair to say that many, if not all, of the parties involved in the plaintiff's side of the lawsuit have some financial stake in the striking of the rules. The cynical take on the situation might be that it's motivated less by the fact that the rules are infeasible and more out of self-interest. How would you respond to that kind of criticism?
Well, I think in most cases, agricultural groups are very, reluctant to enter into lawsuits such as this. There's a sense of trust of how these agencies come up with these rules. But in this case, I think it's much more draconian and much more impactful. And while it does impact our self-interest, it also, impacts, I think, the future direction that this country goes in relating to consumer needs, relating to the overall welfare of the economy of the United States, and other issues similar to that.
Dave Luce from the Illinois Corn Growers Association speaking with Colin Hardman. Multiple lawsuits have been filed to stop the new EPA rules. Several agricultural groups and petroleum interests are suing along with many car dealerships. Those plaintiffs may take comfort from a recent Supreme Court ruling that prevented air pollution regulations from the Biden administration from taking effect. Legal scholars have said the ruling will greatly diminish the authority the federal government has to implement regulations. Luce says it's also possible the new EPA rules will be updated next year under a different administration. The practice of canning food isn't a widespread necessity anymore. Most fresh fruits and vegetables are available at the grocery store year-round. But over the last few years, home canning has gained popularity, as Lily Halloran has this report on the history of canning and how it's making a comeback.
In the 1800s, canning was done in the home, primarily by women. They preserved surplus peas, peaches, corn, and other acidic foods in glass jars, storing them on shelves to eat throughout the year. But the 20th century brought federal food safety regulations, two world wars, and lots of cultural change. Canned goods moved from home kitchens to grocery store shelves as consumers gained confidence in commercial canning.
A simple idea, but one of great promise.
When industrial canning reached its peak in the 1950s, industry leaders were selling it as progress.
We refer to it, and rightly so, as the miracle of the can.
Then the 1960s brought the feminist movement and changed the relationship between women and food preparation. Americans wanted convenience. But now, canning has come home again. People who have the extra time and money are showing off their pantries full of colorful glass jars on Instagram. The hashtag canning has over 960 million views on TikTok.
It's become more of an edutainment for many people.
That's food historian Suzanne Corbett. She says canning has shifted from a vital skill in the kitchen to an at-home hobby.
There's so much fast food and pre-processed food and that have kind of pushed that convenience factor to a situation where our cooking has become performance art in your own home.
People tend to return to canning when things get scary, according to Claire Schmidt, a folklorist at Missouri Valley College. She points to the 2008 recession and the COVID pandemic. For Schmidt's family, 2020 was a time when trips to the grocery store were rare, and they were looking for ways to stay positive.
Okay, your school's closed and everything is weird and the radio is talking about people dying. But hey, we've got canned peaches, and so things aren't all that bad.
Americans left lockdown and returned to work, but canning remains popular, In the last year, Jenna Smith taught more food preservation classes than ever before. A nutrition and wellness educator for the Illinois Extension, she says her students arrive with different experience levels. A grandparent may have taught them, or social media, which isn't such a great source, according to Smith.
I just cringe sometimes at some of the videos and things that I see that are just so, you know, not safe.
But no matter what inspired her students, Smith says they're eager to have more control over the food they eat.
You know, actually seeing when you open up your cabinets, all these beautiful jars of preserved foods, that in itself, I think, is such a joy to many people.
Some have scaled up the old school approach to canning. Kansas City Canning Company owner Tim Tuohy and his workers fill glass jars with unique flavors of fruit preserves, pickles, and various vegetables. Tuohy says he started the company with a plan to marry traditional practices with a modern approach. He took inspiration from childhood memories of canning tomatoes with neighbors.
There's a connection to the past that people can actually identify with because it has that nostalgia to it. I think fondly about spending time in the garden with my dad and picking the tomatoes and spending time with Joan and Frank across the street.
Tuohy says he frequently fields questions from customers who want to try their hand at canning. What once seemed like a dying art is alive and well. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Lily Halloran.
Well, Illinois Republicans are getting ready to head to Milwaukee for the Republican National Convention, where they will nominate Donald Trump to be the party's official nominee for president. The state party now appears to be in lockstep with their pick, even though Trump has twice lost in Illinois, and intense infighting recently cost the Illinois GOP's leader his job. As Alex Degman reports, the next week will likely feature some tough discussions on where the Illinois Republican Party hopes to go.
Trump delegate Kent Gray has more than 200 presidential Christmas cards.
That's the JFK one, the year he died. So they actually got delivered like the day before he left for Dallas.
Wow. That's
the attorney from an upscale suburb of Springfield has been a political junkie most of his life and a name in local Republican circles for some time. He ran Trump's Illinois and Missouri campaigns in 2016 until he booked a Trump rally at UIC in Chicago that was overrun with protesters.
My name's on the contract for the UIC rally / riot, which was pretty wild. I was up at that one.
Trump never showed up. Gray has lost several races in local, state, and national politics, but he was a John McCain delegate in 2008 and an alternate for Trump in 2016. Voters this year selected him and 50 others to be Trump delegates, and he loves it.
You know, a lot of people follow sports, a lot of people follow, you know, TV shows, a lot of people follow all kinds of different stuff. Kind of my interest is politics. And being a delegate to the National Convention is a whole lot of fun because you get to see all basically everybody shows up to speak to the entire assembled masses.
But Gray is attending the RNC at a time of turmoil for the Illinois Republican Party. Its chairman, Don Tracy, said he's resigning after the convention because his fellow Republicans would rather fight each other than Democrats. The party has been in the superminority in Springfield for years and hasn't held a statewide office since Bruce Rauner was governor. Steve Bollage thinks the Illinois GOP has been compromising away conservative values to try winning elections. He says it's not working, and the grassroots folks are tired of it.
We feel like we've been pushed to the edge of a cliff. There's nothing to compromise anymore for us. So any kind of compromise for us becomes, well, we might as well just jump off the cliff.
Bollage lists off a number of grievances, like illegal immigration and perceived special rights for the LGBTQ community. His positions on those reflect the National Republican Party's platform. But Republicans have lost ground in Illinois lately, partly because of the stark divide on issues like that. But Bollage thinks there's plenty for the party to build on, given strong agreements on kitchen table issues like public safety and high taxes.
I haven't had anybody say that they like the idea of all these illegals coming in. I haven't had anybody say that they're happy about, you know, the spending that's going on, because whether you're a Republican or Democrat, you know, J.B. Pritzker's spending money like water.
Regardless of Trump's poor performance in past Illinois elections, Bollage can't wait to nominate Trump once again.
I am super excited. You know, I'm waiting to see what this is all about, because I don't know. But I'm assuming that I'll meet a lot of very interesting people.
Bollage is a diehard Trump supporter, and he's also a supervisor in Homer Township in Will County. After a New York jury convicted Trump of falsifying business records, he raised an upside-down American flag in front of the township's administration headquarters last month. But he put it right side up when people got angry. Kent Gray, the Springfield area attorney, isn't making predictions about the future of the party, but he is sure about a few things next week.
We will get together and we will have a vote on making Donald Trump the presidential nominee, and whoever he picks for vice president is the vice presidential nominee. And we'll have a lot of networking and a few cold beverages and probably some fun in Milwaukee and a whole lot of hot air from politicians speaking for 4 days.
I'm Alex Degman.
We're out of time for Statewide. Join us next week. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Listen to us where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org, as well as on this station. I'm Sean Crawford, and Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.